practices or techniques encourage responsible debate? If you have any interesting examples, please bring them to the table.
Thanks for asking that question. I think it's a good question. And for me, as a mediator, I would say that the first and foundational practice is listening. And it's not listening to find a flaw in the argument or to find a weakness in a position, but it's listening to understand. Understanding isn't the same as agreeing. And listening to understand how the other feels, I think, and in my experience, can be far more illuminating than trying to spot an inaccuracy in the argument. There's a story that I was really inspired by when I trained to be a mediator, and it still stays with me. It was Fisher and Urey, the authors of a book called Getting to Yes, and they told the story of two children, and they both wanted an orange. Guess what? There was only one orange. And so the obvious solution was to split it, and that's what the adult told them to do. But neither child wanted half an orange. Why not? Well, the adult hadn't listened. People are laughing. I expect they're the parents who've been in this situation. The adult hadn't listened and didn't know why they wanted the fruit. Turns out that one wanted the fruit to eat it, but the other wanted the zest to make a cake. So listening can uncover all sorts of things. It can even uncover how both can have the orange.
Thanks very much. Would anybody else, Peter?
Yeah, so I just wanted to say something. Our colleague, Matthew Chrisman, who unfortunately can't be here today, would undoubtedly have made this point, so I'm going to gratuitously plagiarise it, which is that when we approach debate, I think too often we approach debate or discussion as something where we reveal our privately held beliefs. And particularly in society, we aggregate those and then we come to a conclusion. And the conclusion is one based on this belief that we all have a privately held position that won't change and that can be granted in part or in whole through that process or not at all. When in fact, I think the way in which we should approach debate should be, and this gets to kind of the later principles, the 7, 8, and 9 principles in the charter, we should be approaching debate in a way that aims to synthesize new positions. So we should be trying to move away from just the idea that this is my private position that I've entered this with, and I'm going to get this to a certain percentage, maybe 100%, maybe 50%, maybe 0. We should try and synthesize new positions, and that, I think, requires us. And I mean, part of what I'm really interested in about the ethics cap is that it appears to create techniques for us to do that. So rather than there being a winning resolution, you adapt your position and you're able to reflect the differences that emerge through the process of debate. And that, I think, is a process that has more life to it than the kind of confrontational adversarial approach. I work in my day job doing helping people with consultation, that very often is very adversarial. And where we can move people away from the adversarial, the happier they are with the outcomes, even if it wasn't the outcome that they entered the process seeking to gain. So I think if we can see debate as a process by which we synthesize new positions rather than trying to advance our own position, that gets us into a very different space.
Thanks very much. Just to make sure that all the questions get touched on a little bit, I'm just going to move us forward. Sorry, Chris, if you were going to come in on this one, but the second one is basically the flip side of the first one. What gets in the way of responsible debate in your experience?
Oh, gosh, many things. I think most of all, people get entrenched in positions, and that's their starting point rather than it's one that develops through debate. Because if someone gets entrenched through the debate, there's an opportunity to maybe turn them slightly. by being more understanding, more tolerant. The examples I was going to give around this, particularly because I work in Parliament, is where a very good example, which we're all very aware of just now, which is when you try to mislead others. You know, Parliament's supposed to be a place where honesty, integrity, and the aim for ultimate truth is about. And at the moment, I'm in a Parliament where Partygate has been ongoing for the last 6 months, where Boris Johnson is frequently called a liar by many of us in Parliament, which is not the language we're allowed to use. So it's very competitive and very adversarial. But it's because there's a higher, more noble cause in this, which is to bring back debate around values so that we can get on with the heart of the matter that most people care about. So I'd say when you have misleading comments or an erosion of the higher values that we all try to achieve, that becomes a real issue. The other big issue, and it's very real, in the time I've been elected, two colleagues have been murdered. A police officer was murdered in a terrorist attack at the front of Westminster. And four bystanders who happened to be on the bridge at the time also got murdered. Now that's seven people in 7 years as a Member of Parliament. So in all seriousness, to have an informed, well-informed and considerate debate is hugely important. And ultimately, it's not about being right or wrong. What you want at the end of it is winners on both sides. And I was told that by some years ago when I went to Sri Lanka with a former member of the IRA, a very active member, who by the time he was 40, had spent more than half his life in jail. And he was with me going to Sri Lanka to be involved in peace and reconciliation talks after the christening of the Tamil Tigers in the north. And the lesson I learned from him was, I said, how did you get to the table of talking? And he said, it's very simple. We all realized nobody was going to win. The British government finally concluded they weren't going to win. We realized we could continue, but it wasn't going to achieve our ultimate goal either. So it meant, what do we do? We have to find a place where we can both respect each other and both have wins out of it. So there is no loser and a winner. And that's something that's really quite humbling, because in politics it is quite adversarial. But in order to get peace and to get to a positive outcome, it does mean not being wedded to your original position and being allowed yourself to be nudged into a new position that works for both parties.
Thanks. Go ahead, Stephen.
Thanks for that. So I was thinking about this. I was also thinking about my experiences at the Ethics Cup, and Ben was kind enough to invite me along yesterday. Why the Ethics Cup was important, why this discussion was important, is what makes our society better, what makes progress. What makes progress is if we have an issue, we debate and discuss it. So realise why the reason why we invest in Parliament is the reason we invest in these kind of activities, and at university as well. You take an issue and you hope that by the end of the process of debating it and discussing it, you have a better solution than the one that you started out with, which encourages more people. But that relies on, and for me this has always been the pivotal point, that relies on understanding the other side. And if you start from the point that overwhelmingly people want to get to a conclusion that will make the society around them, the world around them, better, that's what we all want. Where we disagree is how you get there and what the best means of achieving that. And that's fine. So I think that you have to start from the point. And in Parliament, when I was in Parliament, that's why the point that Chris made was quite important. You refer to one another as honourable members, because what you're doing is you're giving one another the benefit of the doubt that they have honourable intentions. Something I used to try with students, and I still try with students, is if you feel very passionately about a particular topic, I always encourage that person to argue it from the other side. And it's why I think debate can be quite helpful, to try and debate both sides. I actually find it, when I was involved in politics, it's quite helpful from a political perspective, because unless you understand what the other side is saying, well, you've got no way of tackling that head on when it comes to a more adversarial debate. So really understanding what drives people. Now, what gets in the way, just to tackle that second part of the question? Passion, that's okay. You know, people feel passionate. These are important issues, but also other issues. I think people can feel threatened by change if you're the person that is advocating change, because somebody will always be a loser in that process. Also, another challenge, and we all have this is something that we all struggle with, received wisdom. is that if you think about throughout history, there has been received wisdom. At one point, it was received wisdom that slavery was an integral part of the economic model. That was wrong. And there must be things, and I try and think about things every day. What is the received wisdom that we have today that is stopping us from going forward? And we don't always have that solution. So challenging the status quo, challenging what is received wisdom, is not necessarily a bad thing. And finally, just reflecting on where things can be good, and we'll have more specific points later on. But in Parliament, I remember what was good was a committee system. So I sat on a committee, and Chris has sat on one as well, with colleagues from different parties. But you're all the same team, and you're interrogating an issue not to make a point or win a political fight at the end, but you're working as a team to prepare as good a report as you possibly can to scrutinise the work of government. And I have to say, I found the committee work on a range of issues the most rewarding work that I did from that perspective. Thank you.
I just wanted to pick up on the last point that you made, which is I observe Parliament very closely, and it's night and day watching parliamentarians talk about something that they've done a committee report into and an issue that they haven't done a committee report into. And that really, I think, gives us an idea of people who are paid professionally to understand public policy, given extra time to do that, produce an outcome that is substantially better. The one thing I wanted to say about problems is the thing that I really struggle with in this area is around bad actors. And when we first started discussing this in sort of 2015, people would ask me, what do you mean by a bad actor? And I now have the perfect response, and he was president of the United States for 4 years. You know, somebody who would enter debate not with the purpose of advancing his own position, not with the a policy position or a values position, not with the purpose of engaging with anybody else, but somebody entering debate in order to wreck the debate. And my observation on Boris Johnson is that part of his modus operandi is to try and despoil public debate so that people don't trust politicians, so that he can be elected as the funniest of a bad bunch. And that sort of behaviour, I think, completely ruins the space for public debate. And that's hugely problematic. And beyond doing debate on more things and deepening our understanding of debate, I don't know what the answer to that question is. So if you have thoughts on that, I'd be really interested to hear those.
So picking up on that theme of what can go wrong, I'm going to skip to the last question on the slide. So everybody here should have within arm's reach a list of those principles for responsible debate in the Charter. This question is open to any of the four of you. Which of those principles do you think is most difficult to achieve in practice?
Is this on? Oh, you just left it on. Wow. I think the one that's most difficult is the one that's easiest as well. And that, you know, I've started, so I'll finish. That is around about listening. It's about listening well to each other and teaching people how to listen, which is a skill. We can all listen, but can we listen well? It's a bit like playing a flute, isn't it? Anyone can pick up the flute and blow air into it and move their fingers along the holes, but it takes serious practice to do it beautifully so that people are moved by it. And actually, listening can have an even greater effect. If in mediation, for example, we encourage the participants to listen so that they really understand and empathize with the other perspective, they may be able to uncover an insight into the conflict that hadn't previously been in their minds at all. And that's when we shift and we move to a better place that Stephen and Chris were talking about.
Thanks very much, Ruth. So we have one vote for principle four. What else?
These are all really good. I think you sometimes have to deal with the way the world is rather than the way, you know, the world that you want it to be. We're all people who are interested in this subject, otherwise we wouldn't be in this room at the moment. I think Peter picked up an important points in terms of where our politics and where society is at the moment, it's really quite divided. And when I mentioned receive wisdom earlier on, there are areas of receive wisdom, people are outraged if you raise particular issues or raise any, you know, are you a traitor because you don't think leaving the European Union is a good idea? Are you a traitor because you're not celebrating the Platinum Jubilee this weekend? I mean, all of these different issues that if you read in some areas of the media where you have a responsibility, in all of us, we will all have areas whereby we've got a blind spot, I'm afraid we all do. And I think that we're getting into a place in society whereby we mustn't take for granted this space for shared debate. And I've even seen from the other side where people talk about taking pride in the fact that they don't have friends who are in different political parties. I can't think of anything worse or in a way to make life duller than having friends and colleagues who share different views. And I remember in my time as a parliamentarian, I probably, with the greatest respect to Chris, who I learned a lot from, I probably learned more from speaking to my colleagues in other political parties, actually, because they gave me a different view, a different perspective, one that I was missing when you're trying to represent and hold a whole society. So I put down number 9 right now, seek to identify common ground and shared purpose, because I think that as a broader society, we're failing in that just now.
Great, thanks very much. What I want to do now, apologies to Chris, I want to invite members of the audience to ask whatever questions may have occurred to you over the past 15 minutes, and you can open them up to everybody on the panel. You can pick one particular member of the panel who you want to hear from. It's up to you, and we have a roaming microphone for you. Okay, I saw, yes.
Hi, it was a point that Chris made that made me think about this question, but how do you hold those eroding the values of responsible debate to account? So you gave Boris as an example, but he's, you know, we know he's not the only one. So is there a line to be drawn, and at what point do we draw it? And I would actually be interested to hear a mediator's view on that, to be honest, Ruth, if you don't mind.
All right. So Ruth and then Chris, if you have something to add, that's great.
That'd be great. Thank you.
How do we hold somebody to account? And when do we draw the line?
Draw the line in the sense of just cutting them out, like giving up on them, or? Okay. All right. Thanks.
It's really difficult, isn't it? Because I suppose we've got to establish bad actor. We've got to establish that somebody isn't acting honourably and with good faith. And that in itself is difficult to establish, because if we were to ask the actors that were named earlier, would they say they're acting in good or in bad faith? I think they would say they're acting in good faith. So that in itself is interesting. When negotiators and mediators are up against the wall and are attacked, we try to respond with curiosity. We try to find out more and to really see the other perspective. But if in the end of the day, it's absolutely clear that that there is no moving forward, then we have to acknowledge that reality as well. And there is a time when we have to say that maybe negotiation or mediation isn't right. We've got other more experienced mediators in the room. We've got the director of Scottish Mediation. And I wonder if he wants to say anything. I don't want to put you on the spot, Graham. But actually, I have done.
Too late.
I suppose one of the things that you have to do is at the start of any process is agree the ground rules.
Yeah.
And one of the things a mediator does is they don't determine any of the solutions, but they will determine the ground rules and the management of those ground rules and getting people to sign up. And so it's how you do that through the process, because at some times in a mediation, you're thinking, where on earth is this going? People might be way off, people might even be shouting at each other, but then suddenly you'll be able to focus in on something that somebody says, which then sparks a link with the other person and allows you to move forward. So I think having people who understand how to hold that space is important. Now, they don't have to be mediators. the skills of mediation are skills which are in a whole number of other different areas. Mediators just happen to put them together for a particular process.
Great, thanks very much. And I believe Peter wanted to jump in.
I think there's a really interesting thing here, which is we had another absolutely dreadful school shooting in the United States last week. And at this, in the same week, I think, the families from Sandy Hook won a case against Alex Jones, the TV presenter, for claiming that they were paid actors. That they'd been paid to act out a school shooting in order that the government could take people's guns off them. Within mediation, you've got a quite bounded situation. You can get people to agree to those rules. I suppose my question is, what happens? And, you know, the belief that people at Sandy Hook were paid actors is a widespread belief in the American public sphere. How do we create those rules at a broader level in our public debate so that people don't come in with the belief that a school shooting was just a fiction, it was created, and how do we have a polity in which we can manage those actors, the other type of actor, the people who behave like that, how do we manage that? And I find that the really difficult question.
Yeah, so there's a microphone in the back now.
All right, thanks. So one of the things I find most challenging, I think, and I don't know, I want to know your views, if you thought of it this way, is that one of the issues with getting people to be objective, respectful, reasonable, and debate is that it's incredibly unnatural. If you think of us as a species, we're a pack animal. So we look out for our pack, and we see other packs as a threat. And we consume, and if you ever see a bunch of toddlers interacting with each other, you sort of see human nature in its rawest, and all the parents are doing is trying to tell them, stop taking that boy's toy, don't hit that person, don't invade their space. And I think no other species really is rational with another group of the same species or another organism around them. And so maybe one of the problems we always face is that we are tribal. And so when I lived in DC for a while, and when I was there, I realized that I was very tribal, even about London. Someone would say, where are you from? You're from London. I was like, South London. I'd never say London. I was always South London. And if you meet someone from Yorkshire, outside of Yorkshire, they're from Yorkshire. But if they meet someone else from Yorkshire, they're from North, South, East, or West Yorkshire. You know, we instinctively find a pack, or, you know, is that part of our nature? Is that one of the barriers that we must always overcome, even within ourselves?
Thanks, that's great. Chris and then Ruth.
It's interesting you raise this, because this takes me back to my student years here when I did social anthropology. And I would challenge that and say that's untrue. And that's to put it boldly, because what we discovered, even looking at acts of terrorism as we define them, all the behavior, or virtually all the behavior, certainly as anthropologists looked at, was learned behavior, managed aggression, managed behavior towards others. If you take social media, for example, many people wouldn't behave anything like they do on social media in the public. So it's actually the best way of a debate, for sure, is face-to-face, because people can't hide behind other names or other behaviors. I mean, we mentioned bad actors earlier about Donald Trump. His behavior's impetuous, but he always did it on Twitter because he could get away with it there much more. And the way the debate needs to be accountable, and I think what was just mentioned there about ground rules is absolutely fundamental, because once ground rules are set, again, that's a social construct. Maybe in some ways it does answer your question about we can be a little bit passionate and raw at times, particularly about identity. But if I think back to even earlier in my life, I went to work in Namibia with Rally International, which was a youth development organization. And sadly, it closed this week because of aid cuts. That's part of the reason why it's closed. And it was a British institution for the last 50 years. But what it did is it took young people, and the one I went on was a really difficult group of young people, someone who had never been out of the village before. It was through the Millennium Commission just after the year 2000. And a lot of them came from very challenging backgrounds where their learned behavior was quite competitive and quite identity-based and quite, I'm right, you're wrong. And what you had to say, and this is 18 to 25-year-olds. Now, I wasn't much older at the time. I was 32, I think. And what we did was we'd sit down at the beginning, because there'd be 3 weeks, each with three sets of 3 weeks,
either in the middle of the desert with each other, living in tents with nowhere to go, no stimuli other than what we're doing that day. Or they would be working at a school, which could be problematic, or in a community, in a village. And we'd sit down with a sheet of paper and I'd say, right, can you write down your ground rules? What do you wish to set yourself? And they'd look at each other, 15 of a group, and they'd say, well, I feel really strongly about this. And another person would say, well, hold on, that doesn't work. And so they'd have this discussion, young people making their own rules, and in the end you'd have a page. Swearing was always the funniest, because somebody would say, well, I don't want to hear any swearing. Another one would go, oh, bugger that, that's not happening, we're going to have a bit of swearing. Okay then, how are you going to use your swearing? So you'd have that set of rules, and they were ground rules. So young people, it doesn't matter, it doesn't have to be in politics necessarily, but it's when you have put into a group of people that are not your own group. And going back to your point about London, South London. Okay, so if you're not in your own group, and it's a mixture of people who identify differently from their own traditions, backgrounds, ethnicities, whatever it might be, if they make their own set of ground rules, I found certainly in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a desert, where feelings could get very strong, not least because it was 40 degrees at lunchtime and freezing in the middle of the night, and we're all living on soya mints for 3 weeks, that the arguments we would have be really basic things, but it was done in a very considered manner. And perhaps just my very final point, as a politician, it's the opposite. You go to Parliament, you get no training, you get no set of ground rules other than what's set in the chamber. You have to learn how to moderate. And just that final point, if people break those rules, there should be consequences. And that's the point to raise earlier, which there is a ministerial code, which is currently getting rewritten by the Prime Minister themselves. So there are ground rules for that. We walked out at one point, if you remember, Stephen, in 2016-17, which was breaking the rules, of course, but we were making a point of breaking those rules because it was so important, because we didn't get a sufficient debate the night before.
Thanks. So, let's make sure that Ruth gets to jump in here, and then we'll see if we have time for another question.
Thanks, Ben. I mean, I was really struck by what you said. Thanks for saying that. I mean, in some respects, is it a question about good and bad? And that made me remember that story that I was told about. A grandfather, a Native American grandfather, talking to his grandchild about good and evil. And the grandfather said, within each person, there are two wolves fighting each other for life, and they're really attacking each other. And the grandchild's utterly enthralled by this story and said, grandfather, which one wins? And he said, well, first of all, let's be clear about what these wolves are. One of them is evil and is bad and is selfish and will get you. And the other one is honourable and good and noble. And the child said again, which one wins? And the grandfather looked at the child and said, the one you feed. And I think that's a message for us. Yes, we need to feed. We need to teach people the principles of honourable debate, of responsible debate, so that we can be brave enough to stand up and to speak out for what's good and right.
Thanks very much. So there's one more question, and if you could be so kind as to pick the one person you'd want to hear answer this question, because we're basically out of time. Hold on 1 second, just...
So I was wondering how we concretely foster good debate culture, realizing that if we think about the academic environment rather than public debate, we're really seeing the same problem. Chris mentioned entrenchment. If we think about science is full of entrenched positions, which just stand in the way of progress. And I'm worried that if we don't cultivate a good debate culture within these walls. For academics, it will be very difficult to foster it beyond.
Is there anybody in, well, Stephen's volunteering, so you can have the last word, Stephen.
No, I'm going to make it brief, and it would be remiss of me not to mention this. Alice mentioned this as part of Scotland's Future series, where we're trying to do a little bit of this work. I would recommend that you listen to a podcast of an interview with the principal, where actually I thought she captured really nicely, beautifully put together by Ed and her other colleagues, where I thought she captured really nicely the spirit of debate and discussion within these walls. So rather than me try and better that, because I can't, I'd thoroughly recommend anybody listen to that podcast, which is part of this overall series as well.
All right, on that lovely plug for what we're all doing here today, why don't I hand it back over to Alice, who will give us guidance as to where we go from here.